This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. Today, we listen to a talk Riji gave on the radical roots of Vajrayana practice. He says that Vajrayana Buddhism was originally a wild tradition that was practiced in jungles, but it is now a largely abstract and domesticated religion. He says that our challenge is to recover the authentic primordiality of the tradition. This talk was given at the 2007 Advanced Meditating with the Body Retreat, held at the Blazing Mountain Retreat Center in Crestone, Colorado.
So, how is everybody today? Did anybody get any sleep last night?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Some. Mm-hmm. I heard that the ancestors paid a visit to one of the rooms last night. And they gave you the water initiation. So, what we're doing here in our work together, and also in the Dharma Ocean all together, is we are de-civilizing Vajrayana Buddhism. We're de-domesticating it. Originally, Vajrayana Buddhism came out of the jungles. And some people feel that actually Vajrayana Buddhism is the true teaching of the Buddha, in the sense that, as I mentioned, when he was living in northeast India in the 6th century BC, the impact of the agricultural revolution was being felt very, very strongly. And the even though agriculture had been present in India for at least 4,000 years before that, it remained very, the implications of agriculture had not begun to be felt. There was ecological damage, and we know actually, it's very interesting that even in ancient Mesopotamia, 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, there's ecological damage already. And, forests were turned into wasteland, fields were turned into deserts. Animal waste was building up in certain areas and people had to move on. At that time, of course, no one speculated that this was going to be an accelerating process. But if anybody thinks the modern ecological crisis is unique, it isn't. It's just a further extension of what was going on 8,000 years ago. Almost as soon as agriculture was discovered, the planet was going downhill, and it spread from there. So, at the time of the Buddha, what was happening was the implications of agriculture, which was a tremendous growth in human population. Complex cities already in the Indus Valley civilization, which is 5,000 years old. You had cities where 10,000 people lived, which is a lot of people in that time. But at the time of the Buddha in northeast India, you had a much, much more greatly accelerated population density happening. Political states were beginning to be formed. There was political centralization. armies were beginning to be developed, and people were starting to have wars with each other. The lower caste people were essentially slaves. There was a system of, an economy based on slavery of the lower caste. But the most interesting thing of all was the psychological impact of all of these developments, which was that people lost to a new level their connection with the land and with their ancestral religions. They really were lost. They had become urbanized, and I'm not saying everybody, but there were a lot of people going through that. And the Buddha took a look at the situation, and he saw that there was this new thing developing, which we call the modern ego, the modern sense of self, which is isolated, separated, and defined within its own terms. It's not a sense of self that is based on connectedness, as in the pre-agricultural days. And as I said yesterday morning, the modern ego, which is defined, you know, where the self becomes personal territory. And when we talk about religion and spirituality, when Trungpa Rinpoche talked about it, he talked a lot about personal territory. Personal territory means those parts of our life that we define as me, and we separate ourselves from others, and we become this unique definition of self that's solid, that's continuous, supposedly, and that is separate. The Buddha saw that this was happening in his day, and he saw it was happening in himself. And he said, This doesn't work. I can't do this. I need to find the ancient way. And he actually used those terms. I need to go back and find the ancient way. And he went, and he and others, there were other people who had a similar inspiration, he went into the, where did he go? He didn't go to the cities. He didn't go to the villages. He didn't go to the temples. He didn't go to the human thing. He went into the forest. He went into the jungle. And he went as deep in as he could go until he was so far from any imprint of the human psyche, he was free. He was free from its pernicious influence. And then he began to work on himself in that context, in the wild. And he discovered that the what in his time was the modern overlay, the modern ego, the modern sense of self, the modern society in his day, this gathering momentum of urbanization and all of the psychological and spiritual consequences of that were not real. And actually what he said, this is not real. This is empty. There's nothing here. There's nothing here for anybody. It's dead. It's a shell. And he discovered his own connectedness with everything. And as I said yesterday morning, what he said was, he framed this doctrine, which I don't know if he actually spoke of it this way, but this is the way, later Buddhists talked about it, that everything in the universe was him. That whatever went on in his body and mind were a reflection of his connectedness with everything that had ever been and was and ever would be throughout all time and space. When you realize that what you are in your life is a cosmic event, it's not personal at all, then there is a kind of letting go into the greater whole, the totality. You begin to recognize that the totality is actually, you are an expression of the totality. You are not an expression of you. That is the aboriginal insight. It's the aboriginal way. And we know this from, as I said again, from both from archaeology, paleontology, and modern anthropological studies of people at that with that style of culture, an ancient style. So the interesting thing is, though, for us, is that when the Buddha came to that insight, you know, here's the problem with Buddhism. It became converted into an urban domesticated language, which means that it's separate from nature. His insight was a natural insight. It was insight into his embeddedness in the natural world. But Buddhism, like the other so-called great religions, created an abstract, disembodied vocabulary for talking about all of these things. So what was a completely embodied realization, where he let go of all of the entrapments of his modern urbanized culture, it got converted into very abstract language. So his insight was he opened to the world. And in the very early stories about the Buddha, he talks about how interconnected he feels with all beings everywhere. He saw their suffering, he saw their karma, he saw what they were doing to themselves, and he wept. And he remembered all of his own lives, everything that he'd ever been, and he wept. And he realized that nature is utterly free, and nature is the vehicle of reality itself in the jungles, in the weather, in the land. And he wept. His insight was so embodied and so human and so full. But the urbanized world around him was not able to receive his insight. And you go down through Buddhist history and you see that all of these very grounded, very embodied, very primordial ways of feeling and seeing and experiencing the world became converted into an extremely abstract philosophical terminology. Isn't that true about Buddhism? It's very abstract. Now, what it's talking about is very real, but the thing is, when you tell people who already just, you know, live in their concepts, you give them more concepts, it's not helpful. It doesn't work. The Vajrayana is a unique tradition because it stayed in the jungle longer than any of the other Buddhist traditions. Most of the other Buddhist traditions came out of the jungle and they became domesticated. Now, what it means to be domesticated, there's a distinction between wildness and domestication. And this is, if you want to read, Gary Snyder has written beautifully. He has a book called The Practice of the Wild. Domestication or wildness is that things are given room to be what they are. Things are given latitude, they're given room. Animals roam, they're not put in zoos, they're not made into pets. They live in their habitat and they roam and they live and they die and they interact with the whole world. And humans were originally wild. They roamed and they weren't put in cages. Domestication means that human beings create environments for the world, and, you know, like with dogs. If you want to read about the difference biologically between animals that have been domesticated and wild animals, you can read Paul Shepherd. Tame animals are basically spineless, sniveling creatures. They have all of the wildness has been taken out of them. And this doesn't just include house pets, although house pets are, you know, very much that way. They've become, I mean, biologically we're talking about now, they have no strength, they have no genetic strength at all. The wildness, the curiosity, the ferocity, the independence has been bred out of them. But it's also true of all of our domestic animals that we use, you know, cows and chickens and pigs and goats. They are all 10%, you know, in terms of their biological strength, they're 10% of what they are in the wild state. Vajrayana initially is a wild tradition, meaning that the people who practiced it lived in the jungles, and they practiced and they roamed and they got food wherever they could, and some of them never went near human habitations. And they said that, you know, they said the primordial world is the true world, and that's the world I'm living in, and that's the world where I can realize the fullness of my human existence. But the Vajrayana became domesticated. It happened later, maybe around the 10th century, which is that's like 1500 years after the Buddha. So, you know, the Vajrayana was a wild tradition for a long time. And with the domestication, we have, with all due respect and, you know, with all due appreciation, we have this thing today we call Tibetan Buddhism, which is a very abstract tradition, strangely enough. What you see today as Tibetan Buddhism is not the heart of Vajrayana Buddhism, and it's definitely not the heart of what was going on in Tibet. What we see is the domesticated version, where you have these deities, and the question is, well, what do they have to do with anything? You have these, you know, endless liturgies, and you have these endless teachings, and you have no idea what they have to do with in most cases. I mean, you know, if you're a very creative person and you practice a lot, you can kind of translate them into experiential language. But basically, it's a self-existing realm of practice and religion. It's an organized religion. It has its hierarchies. It has its elite. It has the slaves at the bottom, who are the Western people, with all due respect, again, who basically's job is to feed the elite. You have these endless, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hour sadhanas that people are expected to do. No explanation given of how it connects with life. I mean, this is not unusual. We see this in Christianity and some of the other religions, where you have a self-existing, in my opinion, fantasy world that has been created, and then your job is to try to take that on as your way of being, and it doesn't really work, and nothing really changes. If you can live inside that kind of a fantasy world, good for you. I mean, if you want to dress up like a Tibetan and, you know, mimic the values and attitudes of Tibetan people, that's fine. I mean, if that makes you happy and you can do it, I guess it's okay. But the thing is, it has nothing whatsoever to do with the original wildness and freedom and exploratory human journey that is what the Vajrayana was, and still is, in very isolated places. I'm sure in Tibet there are still people practicing the authentic thing. Somebody told me that in Orissa in India, even though we think, in the West, we think Buddhism was wiped out there in the 12th century, people have told me that there's still Vajrayana practitioners there who are doing the ancient thing. It could be, but they're in hiding for very good reasons.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.